Hello, and thank you for joining us for this MedCast series titled Mitigating Cardiovascular Risk in Obesity. I am Dhiren Patel, a clinical pharmacist and an adjunct associate professor of pharmacy practice at the Mass College of Pharmacy in Boston, Massachusetts.
I'm Bob Bush. I'm a practicing endocrinologist and director of clinical research at the Albany Medical Center Endocrine Group in Albany, New York.
In this episode, we will examine the cardiovascular impact of obesity and delve into the potential benefits of newer weight loss medications in mitigating CV risk and heart failure. To discuss more of this, we are joined by Dr. Fatima Cody Stanford. Thank you, Dr. Stanford, for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I am Dr. Fatima Cody Stanford. I'm an obesity medicine physician and scientist at Massachusetts General Hospital, an associate professor of medicine and pediatrics at Harvard Medical School. I serve as the director of equity for the endocrine division and the director of diversity for the Nutrition Obesity Research Center here at Harvard.
Thank you so much again, and thank you both. I know there's a lot of topics we want to cover. We hear about this topic in GLP on a daily basis. It happens from lay media outlets, medical societies. And if we could just maybe start, Dr. Stanford, and kind of talk about how obesity contributes to the CV risk and kind of what are some of the primary mechanisms that are involved?
So, Dhiren, this is a wonderful question. I appreciate you for asking this. And, you know, there's a lot that we know, but there's a lot that we still don't know about obesity and its contributions to cardiovascular risk. What we do know is when people carry excess adipose, and that's excess fat and storage of fat, it leads to differences in the mechanics of how the heart functions. When you carry excess weight, the body has to use that excess weight, or the heart still has to function even though that excess weight exists. So you can imagine it's a bit more of a burden on the body when someone carries a high degree of excess weight. This is particularly, germane when we're talking about issues like hypertension, cardiovascular disease and risk factors, and even, looking at individuals as they get further along in life, so older age, where the demand on the heart tends to be more. There's a lot of drivers that we're still yet to understand, but we do overall find that when people carry less degree of excess weight, it contributes to better heart function. Now, I do want to distinguish what I mean when I talk about excess fat. We have that visceral adipose tissue, that adipose tissue around key organs, around things like the heart, which can really affect heart function. And then we have subcutaneous adipose tissue, or that tissue that's right beneath the skin surface that doesn't seem to have as much of an impact on heart and heart function. And when we look at the differences between persons that carry high levels of visceral adipose tissue, where we have a high degree of burden, versus more subcutaneous adipose tissue, we have less of a heart burden in those individuals.
That's really, really helpful. Dr. Bush, anything else that you'd like to add?
Well, as an endocrinologist, as you know, the obesity epidemic has paralleled the diabetes epidemic. So whether diabetes is just one of the factors or one of the important factors with, high triglycerides, low HDL, diabetes, hypertension, all that framework that was all inflammatory and leads to heart disease as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And, recently semaglutide was in the news for top line findings from the SELECT trial that showed significant CV benefits. Could you both, provide your remarks and kind of your commentary on some of those key findings? Because it was a pretty big landmark trial, especially when you think about when it comes to, the obesity arena. We've seen some of these landmark trials previously in the diabetes world, but kind of it's first in the obesity arena. So Dr. Stanford, maybe I'll start with you.
So definitely when we look at the SELECT trial, as to be expected, those that were on semaglutide lost body weight, right? We're looking at over 13% total body weight loss, which is really a sizable difference in body weight. And that degree in body mass, we talked about heart function, where you carry that excess adipose, that can lead to poor function, physical function. One of the things, though, that we've seen from, other GLP-1s, even prior to this in meta-analyses, is we've seen this reduction in MACE, that 20% reduction in MACE or major adverse coronary events that we saw in this big trial really wasn't a surprise to those of us that have been looking at GLP-1s across the spectrum. Much like was mentioned when we were thinking about endocrinology, exenatide was that first GLP-1 that came on the market back in 2005. And if you look at those early study results, we were seeing differences. When we look at pooled meta-analyses, we have seen a significant reduction in major adverse coronary events in those studies. So this was just really, I think, icing on top of the cake. I don't know if I should be using icing as we're talking about semaglutide. But we weren't really surprised by this outcome. This outcome was one that was expected. Actually, it would have been really surprising if we didn't see a reduction in major adverse coronary events like we've seen from other studies with other GLP-1s previously.
That's really helpful. And Dr. Bush, you were one of the investigators, and so you've seen it from kind of both ends. You know, could you comment a little bit about, you know, as you were in the study, an investigator, and to now kind of what the full published results look like?
Yeah, so exactly highlighting what you said, the diabetes trial showed with dulaglutide and rewind trial and liraglutide with the leader trial and semaglutide with the sustained trial, and also had those results. Interestingly, the dula and sema lowered stroke as the major push. So it'll be very interesting when they come out with what lowered the MI stroke death, the MACE, with SELECT. Was it stroke or was it all of it? All of it may have contributed, but it was interesting what the major factor is. But again, not a surprise with that. And as you know, there are other trials with some of the other GLPs going on now. So this is an exciting time to practice medicine. The problem is Medicare doesn't cover these drugs. So it's like you could be on the drug and then congratulations, you're 65, you're on Medicare. Goodbye, your drug's gone. You have to pay for it. No one can afford it.
Actually, do you mind if I speak to that? I'm really glad that you brought up that point. That point is so important because I have at least a third of my patients are older adults. And so those patients are, you know, between 60 and about 90. And you exactly hit the nail on his head. Those patients that are doing great have had this great weight with body weight, but not only body weight. We're looking at those cardiovascular risk factors, right? We see improvement in their LDL, HDL, triglycerides. We see improvement across a broad range of factors. And like you said, as soon as they hit Medicare, as soon as they decide to stop with their employer-sponsored insurance, all of a sudden, all of those benefits that they gained just vanish. And it's really unfortunate that there's these, I would call it discriminatory practices towards older adults, the ones most likely to benefit from these agents and the benefit they have on the body.
No, that's helpful. And that's a topic I want to come back to because I think it deserves a longer discussion. The question that I have, and we have top line, and you kind of mentioned it, we'll see what kind of individual factors contribute to this CV risk reduction. But what are you thinking based off of what you've seen? You know, the question that sometimes you hear thrown out is like, well, is the CV risk reduction because they lost the weight? Or do we think there's independent, you know, CV risk factors? Like how early on the diabetes drugs were questioned, and then we realized it is pleiotropic effects that we're seeing with some of these agents. And so maybe Dr. Stanford, you know, what is your kind of thought process around the CV risk reduction?
You know, a lot of what we've seen, and this is just my analysis, is that it's not necessarily the effect on the heart muscle itself, right? This particular drug and the effect on the heart muscle, but, you know, the metabolic drivers associated with the contribution to heart failure, et cetera. And so I think it is these downstream metabolic factors, going back to what was stated early about obesity being a chronic inflammatory condition. And we know that semaglutide or GLP-1s do have an impact on the inflammation associated with obesity as a chronic disease. And so I think it's really that or those metabolic factors, as opposed to, like I said, an effect of the drug on the heart muscle itself that are really driving these changes that we've seen in the SELECT trial.
Anything else, Dr. Bush?
I would think the same thing. The lowering triglycerides, raising HDL, lowering blood pressure, lowering CRP. So all those other factors that have often benefited the heart, not a surprise, benefits the heart, maybe something we don't even know about yet. So it's all good.
No, that's really helpful. And then when you kind of think about the weight loss, I mean, this is pretty robust weight loss that we're seeing from this. And not that it needs additional, you know, data to kind of cement its place and where it kind of fits, you know, into therapy. But, you know, how do you see these cardiovascular benefits kind of bolstering its overall portfolio? We know from a weight loss standpoint, we see some robust efficacy, but do you think that's going to have a significant shift into kind of how, what our approach is? Because, you know, we were talking about this, you know, earlier, you know, you only have 50% of the market right now that technically has coverage, right? We have commercial, we don't have CMS recognizing it. It's been since 2013, the AMA has recognized it as a chronic condition. And it's kind of sad that we're still, you know, continuing to make these cases and we're looking for a cardiovascular outcome trial to then, you know, further justify something that should just be standing on its own. So how are you, you know, leveraging this in your patient conversations, payer conversations, even at your institutions to say we need to look at this differently?
So I think this is for me. I'm not sure if this is for me, but I'm happy to address this. You know, I've spent a lot of time advocating for coverage of anti-obesity medications for their weight benefit, but mostly for their health benefit, because I never give my patients a target weight. I give them target health. So we look at their metabolic factors. We're looking at their cholesterol. We're looking at their liver function tests. We're looking at their hemoglobin A1Cs, their fasting insulin levels. All of these things are responsive to GLP-1s. And when we demonstrate that all of what the data is showing and consistently shows, it really is a no-brainer that there should be coverage. I think that there is a finance issue, however. When we look at the number of individuals that have obesity, the number of individuals that have diabetes, as we talk about these two parallel pandemics, the numbers are quite large. And when we look at the cost of these medications, it's quite exorbitant. So what typically, when you're looking at payers, they're thinking about, okay, wait a minute, how much do I have to pay out and what is the benefit? We don't yet have those studies that demonstrate the cost benefit ratio very, very well in terms of, like, if I start a patient that's at risk for major coronary disease, heart failure, et cetera, on these medications, how do I prevent downstream impacts, hospitalizations, ICU visits, et cetera, which we know are much more burdensome on the healthcare system. And so I think that, you know, we need some more of those cost benefit ratios. We need to be talking to our economists, you know, pulling together our medical minds with their minds to demonstrate the efficacy and the benefit for the overall population in terms of these agents and how we can prevent all of these downstream really high cost associated with frequent hospitalizations and significant degree of morbidity associated with obesity and obesity related disease, particularly cardiovascular and endocrinopathies like type 2 diabetes.
No, that's really helpful. And yeah, I think it's just going to be something that's going to be a work in progress, because, you know, I understand both sides of it, because the financial piece is a big one, right? They have had, you know, Kaiser Family Foundation recently came out with something and showed kind of what the burden to CMS would be, you know, if this was something that was covered, and none of these numbers are small. So definitely understand that. But then, you know, how do you withhold something that has such positive benefit from, you know, our patient population, right? Dr. Bush, what are your thoughts and kind of your conversations that you have as this additional body of evidence now is out there?
Yeah, so having positive cardiac benefit is great, and probably heading off diabetes in someone with pre-diabetes is terrific as well. But again, when they are 65 years old, to give the patient really a gift that they can improve their health, and then at 65, you have to stop therapy and scramble for something else, and there's no something else available now. And a lot of our health plans where we used off-label semaglutide or tirzepatide off-label in patients where they couldn't have the drug rider for commercial insurance, they're now not allowing those drugs anymore because it's off-label use and they don't have the indication for that. So it's a big problem. You know, and patients read about this, read about the benefits, hear about the benefits, and then, well, I can't afford that. I can't get it. No one's going to private pay that amount of money for life. And as a pediatrician, even step teens using the drug earlier on, that's a whole lifetime of the drug.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I do have pediatric patients that I have on these medications that have had tremendous benefit. It's really interesting because I think, you know, when we're treating pediatric patients, we get a chance to see how we influence their life before they begin life as an adult, and the weight stigma and bias, their overall cardiovascular health. Because, you know, if we're starting with these poor health parameters, like you said, as a teenager, imagine what we would get at, you know, 40 or 60 or, you know, even beyond that. We're looking at really poor life expectancy, greater morbidity. I mean, it's just, but why not treat it early? And I've seen significant benefit in my pediatric patients. Their whole life changes, like I said.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. And I hear the same from, you know, other clinicians. You hear that from patients. You hear these, you know, great stories of what it's been able to do. So we had that, you know, positive CV data that has come out regarding semaglutide and in the SELECT trial. But then we also have another trial, the STEP HFpEF trial. So Dr. Bush, maybe kind of tell us a little bit about what that trial is and what this could mean in the HFpEF space from a heart failure standpoint.
So heart failure with preserved ejection fraction, other than the recent addition of SGLT2s, didn't have much treatment. The typical drugs for heart failure were not effective. They had the ARNIs and the mineralocorticoid inhibitors and beta blockers. So this was a big underserved area and very common with obesity. So to see this New England Journal study come out that it improved, not only did it improve symptomatology and hospitalizations, but a BNP went down, everything went the right direction. Doesn't yet have that indication, but that'll be a big deal if it's approvable for patients, particularly the Medicare population, just for the heart failure, not so much for the obesity. So this is very exciting that we have another drug in our armamentarium for heart failure with preserved ejection fraction. It was a big deal with SGLT2s, mm-hmm. and this will be a bigger deal because of the other benefits that that GLP-1s have.
And, you know, and just really kind of a piggyback on what Dr. Bush just stated, what I'm seeing in the cardiology space, neither of us are cardiologists, is I'm seeing this high level of interest amongst cardiologists, particularly as it relates to GLP-1s. As we know, there are some anti-obesity agents that have had a really rocky situation, I will say, in terms of their approval by the FDA and removal due to heart valvulopathy and other issues. And so cardiologists were very reticent to consider anything in the realm of weight regulation and things of this sort. But as they are seeing this data come out, I can tell you I'm being invited to speak at numerous statewide chapters for the American College of Cardiology because they're trying to figure out how they can begin to utilize these medications within their practice, particularly preventive cardiologists that are, you know, really trying to prevent really longstream or downstream cardiovascular disease. So I can tell you there's a high degree of interest from us as providers, physicians, particularly because we want the health of our patients to improve, not deteriorate over time.
And, you know, where you sit, you've had the opportunity to use this drug and kind of see it from, you know, the adolescent, from, the, you know, all the way from the pediatric side to the older adult, as you mentioned. What are some of the, you know, concerns or, you know, things that you need to watch out for those that have maybe not utilized this drug? And I hear that a lot because, you know, we've had a supply chain issue specifically with this medication, which has caused some, you know, starts and stops. But Dr. Stanford, maybe we'll start with you first.
Well, you know, so I'll talk about, you know, a few different things, Dr. Patel, as we look at what's been going on. First of all, you know, we have to think about side effects. That we can't pretend like these medications are without them. And I really think that one of the things I've learned in caring for patients, and I've had over 2,000 patients on semaglutide at this time, is that you really need to listen to the patient and what they're telling you, the feedback they're giving you. So if we're looking at the package insert in terms of titration, right, we have 0.25, 0.5, 1, 1.7, and 2.4 is the dose titration. And typically we're supposed to titrate this every month. But let's say the patient is having refractory nausea and vomiting. Does it really make sense to double the dose for that patient when they're having those issues? Or maybe they need to hang out at 0.25 for several months, even 6 months. I have patients that may be their maintenance dose and they do just well on that dose. So listen to the patient is really, really important. And I think it's important to work with a clinician that has experience in using these medications and mitigating side effects, because for most patients, they are transient in nature. Another thing to think about is the supply chain issue has been my greatest nightmare in 2022 and 2023. I say that not to bash any company, but to recognize that my patients may have to go through calling 7 or 8 different pharmacies to find the medication. Some of them are driving 2 or 3 hours into more rural areas where the demand for the medication is not as high. I've even had patients fly to Montana from Massachusetts to get medication. The fact that this is the reality of what my patients are having to go through when they're getting benefit is really quite stressful for them, for their families, for me, for my staff, for the prior authorization teams. I mean, it is quite overwhelming. I've never seen anything quite like this in terms of the significant issues or journeys with regards to supply chain. And so I'm concerned. I know that tirzepatide, for example, is being considered for fast track through the FDA for approval, but my patients that have diabetes right now can't get it. So what happens when we open the pool to those that have obesity, and we know that's a much larger pool of individuals, I am quite frightened by the possibilities.
Anything else?
We have the same issues. Okay. In fact, our medical center that usually stocks these drugs and mails the drug to the patient after the prior auths, we get a weekly update on what the inventory is, that we can't start new starts because they only have the 1.7 and the 2.4, and they don't have the lower doses to start. And the same with tirzepatide. So these drugs are in extremely high demand. I didn't know you could fly to Montana, but don't have your patients drive to Albany because our patients are busy taking these drugs. And part two of what you said is it does take an experienced clinician to know how to tweak these drugs. As you know, endocrinologists love tweaking. We tweaked insulin for many years, and now these drugs. Our biggest cardiology group is smart enough to hire doctors of pharmacy. So they hire PharmDs, and the PharmDs are the ones who initiate and maintain and get the phone calls back and forth. Oh, yeah. So even if the cardiologists don't know what a GLP does, the PharmDs do that and do it for their patients. So they have the PharmDs do all the prescribing there.
I love it. That's a great strategy. Dr. Patel, tell us all about your friends and send them our way.
There's many of them that are doing this. And, you know, they say the same things as, you know, the supply has definitely been an issue. And so, you know, here's kind of a loaded question. We have a supply chain issue. We'll talk a little bit about pipeline agents here in a second, but we only have 50% of the addressable market, self-insured employers that are commercial pay currently cover it. We have this, you know, demand supply issue. You've done some legislative work and you've talked on this topic. If you're in front of CMS, what do you say? And then the same token, what's happening, I think we're taking a step back with those commercial payers in which they did previously cover it, because in the first and second quarter of this year, their GLP costs have gone up so much that their employee overall costs have gone up to the point where now open enrollment's coming and they're thinking of restricting it for those that were already paying it and were those early adopters. So what would your kind of pitch to them be? Because now we're, I think, taking a step back there because they can't afford, because they're on the hook for the cost there, right? So if someone's bill is going to go up hundreds of million dollars in your publicly traded company, how do you manage that?
You know, these are tough questions. I have had a chance to speak to both CMS and the White House recently. And so I'll just tell you what I told them. You know, I said that we have to treat these patients with equity and care. Right now, federal employees here in the United States all have access to these medications. Isn't it not equitable to ensure that, you know, federal employees have access, but those that are in Medicare or those that are covered by Medicaid aren't covered? It really comes down to an equity issue. And I mean, treating people exactly how you would want to be treated. That's something that I've raised. Federal employees did not always have coverage or access, but now they do, and they kind of get the benefit. Why wouldn't you not share that benefit? Now, I recognize the cost is high, and like I said, this is when our economists need to come to work with us to show and demonstrate model. We have to have modeling. We can use AI and modeling to look at what is the downstream benefit. So while the upfront cost may be steep, what are we looking to save long term? And that long term is going to be beyond that CBO estimate, that Congressional Budget Office estimate, which is a 3-year duration cycle, right? Like, it's going to be beyond that. We're going to be looking at that 10-year plan, right? The average duration of times patients are with me is at least 10 years. It's a marathon, not a sprint, right? So if we began to think of it in that way and think of the long term benefits, that's important, and look at the overall health. And when we look at the overall health, look at issues, particularly if we're talking to employers, of presenteeism and absenteeism. What's the degree of functioning when actually present? Are they sick, or are they functioning, fully functioning, able to contribute to the profits of the company? And these are things that I think need to be really addressed so that we can demonstrate that overall the population's health can improve when utilizing these agents for those that appropriately need them.
Yeah, no, those are all excellent points. And Dr. Bush, you mentioned it earlier, you know, Ryder. And so, you know, for some of our viewers, they might not realize these anti-obesity medications fall on a separate medication rider, where that self-insured employer needs to activate this rider. It's not like you're getting your aspirin, your statin. Someone needs to decide that they're going to activate this for that employee to have that coverage. You know, what are some of the success stories that you've seen in your area? Because you, where you are, you have good coverage.
We do. The state worker has good coverage where we are. But again, once you're 65, goodbye, you're done. Some of these people want to work beyond that so they could have commercial insurance to pay for their meds. So even though they're over 65, they don't have to use Medicare as their drug plan. That would be something. And the other thing, which is sad, but if you have diabetes, you get your semaglutide up to 2 milligrams for the diabetes, or tirzepatide up to 15 milligrams. Doesn't yet have the cardiac outcome study, but hopefully we'll have that. So if you have diabetes, you're better off even than if you just had obesity, even though the drug will prevent the diabetes. If you have diabetes, the drug is covered. If you don't have diabetes, if you don't have the obesity rider, you're out of luck. And if you're on Medicare, you're out of luck.
Yeah. I would love to. Thanks, Dr. Bush. You made an important point. I've written about this. You know, this is the one time in our, I guess, treatment regimen where I get excited when my patients get a type 2 diabetes diagnosis. As soon as that hemoglobin A1C hits 6.5, I know I can get these agents for them. But isn't it such a horrible thing for your doctor to want your A1C to get into that level so then you can get the medicine? I think it's horrible. I mean, I don't want them to have diabetes, but I know once I get there, then I can improve their health much better than I can with obesity as an individual diagnosis. And that is really a sad state of affairs for us to say that we're excited when our patients just cross that threshold into having type 2 diabetes. So you know what? We can say, and we can demonstrate to the insurer, whoever they are, that this patient has diabetes and warrants use of this medication, because we are more readily acknowledging, as we have for quite some time, type 2 diabetes as a disease process that requires therapy. We are well within our purview to ignore obesity, as we have for, you know, generations now. And so we really need to shift that thought process, because I shouldn't be getting excited for my patients to cross that threshold over to diabetes to get access to agents they should have had access to anyway.
And you don't want to tell your patient whose A1C is 6.4, oh, if you just gain a little bit more weight, the drug is covered, even though I have a drug for you now that could head things off.
Yeah, hopefully this stuff, you know, changes soon, and, you know, we can kind of all sit around the table and figure out kind of, you know, a path forward. You both mentioned tirzepatide, and that's something, it's obviously on the market, type 2 diabetes indication that you're excited about for when that obesity indication happens. But what are some other therapies or clinical trials that you're involved with in terms of obesity that you think could also have, you know, the same magnitude of benefit, whether it be from weight loss or also from cardiovascular standpoint? We'll start off with you, Dr. Bush.
Well, since tirzepatide has such good weight loss as well, and there's no head-to-head study, but just on paper, it looks like the weight loss is better. They don't have that cardiovascular outcome study yet, but they're doing that. So, of course, everyone wants to get the newer, better mousetrap. So Novo was working on a combination of an amylin semaglutide product, CagriSema, with even better weight loss. And the weight loss looks great at 30 weeks and didn't even stop going fully down yet. I think it was like 15-16% mm-hmm. at 30 weeks, not at a year. And then there are some oral GLPs being worked on. Novo has high-dose oral semaglutide, the 50 milligram rather than 14 milligram dose for diabetes. And then Lilly has an oral product that you don't have to take with food called orforglipron. And Lilly has the infamous triple G with the glucagon agonist with GIP and GLP, where glucagon agonist, maybe you could get it to that it increases energy expenditure besides the appetite suppression. So it'll be a whole new world, but the question will be, will it be covered on Medicare, and will commercial plans cover these drugs?
Right. I mean, I think, you know, Dr. Bush did a great job covering them. Just a little bit of a tag on to the retatrutide study, which is that triple G, as people will call it, with the GLP-1, the GIP, and the glucagon, is that, you know, the early data that came out in the New England Journal this summer showed that we're looking at 24.2% total body weight loss at 48 weeks. Now, that's really important to note, because if we look at semaglutide, tirzepatide, and those trials, we're looking at a duration of at least 68 weeks or 72 weeks. We never even saw data that took us out that far. We stopped at 48, or at least that's what the trials demonstrated. So I don't think we've even seen the degree of total body weight loss associated with it. Now, when we get into both the dual agonists like tirzepatide or the triple agonist like retatrutide, one of the things that I think we'll get pushback on is that, unlike the GLP-1, where we have, you know, you know, data from 2005 demonstrating benefits. We don't have much when we're looking at the GIPs and the glucagon receptors. We just don't have, you know, medications that have been on the market that we can go back and do meta-analyses. These are going to be new agents on the market to consider, and we're going to have to get those longer term data to really demonstrate their benefit over time. And so that's the only thing I think pause that I think we'll see is, like, we can't say, oh, we have all of this data, GLP-1s we do, but for the GIP and the glucagon receptor components, we just don't have those, that long-term data.
Okay, that's helpful. You know, when we think about diabetes, we have tons of tools in our toolbox. When it comes to obesity, not as many. You know, we could probably count on one hand. Dr. Stanford, you know, do you use combination therapy? What are your thoughts on combination therapy? What do you see in the future? Because usually what happens is one agent has good efficacy, another one does, and then it's like, does 1 + 1 = 3? But maybe you could comment a little bit about kind of the combination approach, or you think combining some of these other modalities may help from a CV standpoint.
Yeah, absolutely. So I have been a long-term utilizer of combination therapy, much like treating resistant hypertension for patients with obesity, particularly severe obesity and obesity associated with high degree of comorbidities. We often need multiple treatment modalities, which include lifestyle, medication, even metabolic and bariatric surgery. And so for many of my patients, they have a combination thereof. And when we go into the pharmacotherapy realm, they may be on combination agents. Maybe they're on phentermine, topiramate, metformin, and semaglutide, right? So we wouldn't start those all at once. We don't throw the kitchen sink at them. We start one agent, you know, get the maximum benefit, meaning they reach that plateau, and then add the next agent. And we do it in a kind of a stepwise fashion. I think that's important to note. For many of my patients, they have been on combination therapy for an excess of a decade or longer and have been doing well. For those agents that were doing well on some of those more traditional agents, I didn't need to put them on a semaglutide, because if they lost 30% of their total body weight with Fintope, why do I need to start them on semaglutide, right? Those are much cheaper agents, and that's the fentermine topiramate combination, for example. And I don't need to put them on an agent, you know, because we've already gotten and sustained their benefit for weight response. And so I think it's important to recognize that when we're looking at these agents, they're working on different parts of the body. Semaglutide is typically upregulating that anorexigenic or POMC, propionylmalonic pathway, and downregulating that AGRP pathway, whereas phentermine is inhibiting norepinephrine reuptake within the hypothalamus, and then topiramate is stimulating GABA secretion within the brain. And so these different pathways of the brain can be complementary in terms of treating people with resistant obesity.
Thank you so much. Thank you both for joining us on this MedCast episode. So we learned, it was awesome to have Dr. Stanford come and kind of share with us regarding some of the obesity medications. But more importantly, I think it's been a kind of breakthrough in this medication. She mentioned the fact that we've had medications for obesity in the past. Some of them have had a checkered past, specifically when it comes to CV risk. In many cases, it's been negative information. And so I think it was really important for the community to see that this wasn't more of the same. And we actually had dedicated cardiovascular outcomes trials that looked at this CV risk, even though they weren't mandated. We know in the diabetes world, these were mandated, you know, because of the Avandia fiasco in 2008. So can you walk us through a little bit about, you know, what some of these landmark trials are and what it means for this space, and specifically with the drugs that they're associated with?
So the SELECT trial, which the top line results were announced, given that semaglutide had cardiac benefit in the diabetes trial, they naturally did a trial just with obesity, but with these patients had to have a stroke or an MI or ASCV to get in. So they were high risk obese patients with BMI over 27 who didn't have diabetes, and the top line results showed 20% lowering of MI stroke death. And that's phenomenal. And casts a long shadow in the future when you're starting medication. As she very nicely explained, maybe they'll come up with some economic analysis to show it's worth giving to anyone who's at risk, because the benefit far outweighs the cost in the future of these patients. And then to complement it, the STEP-HFpEF trial with heart failure with preserved ejection fraction, same thing, positive results, published in New England Journal. Again, not yet in the label, but these two indications should make managed care and hopefully Medicare move forward in saying their cost-benefit analysis, that it's worth treating to avoid the heart disease, because you'll have major benefit for, even though the high cost, you'll save money in the long run for heart failure, hospitalization, stroke, MI, those other problems.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing that, you know, I'm kind of hearing is that, and Dr. Stanford mentioned it, is that this medication now is pulling together a lot of professions. You know, you have pediatricians, you have endocrinologists, you have cardiologists, you have primary care. And so the hopefully, you know, the hope is that as this coverage expands, even though we only have, you know, the commercial side of the house currently paying for these medications, but I think if, you know, it's going to take a village to take care of these patients, because the statistics, and we just look at here in the US, I mean, everyone is affected by this. And so, you know, I'm hopeful that more and more therapies become available and that it further reduces the price and it makes it more affordable and equitable, like Dr. Stanford said, for everyone. It shouldn't just be for, you know, if you're commercially insured or for the federal employees. It should something like this, especially with the data that it has, it should be available to everyone. So thank you again for taking the time and joining us on this MedCast episode.